Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is Wednesday, April 27th, 2022 at 1:40 p.m. Present today are Representative LaVaughn, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, and we have Representative Drummond with us today. Welcome. This afternoon, we're going to consider House Bill 413, School Facilities, and House Bill 350, School Bond Debt Reimbursement. First is House Bill 413, Facilities Constituting a School, by the House Education Committee. Co-chair of that committee, Representative Drummond, is carrying the bill. Welcome to House Finance, Rep. Drummond. If you could place yourself on the record and introduce your bill. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me, Madam Co-chair and members of Finance. For the record, I am Representative Harriet Drummond of House District 18, Midtown Anchorage, and the Independent Republic of Spinard. The House Education Committee introduced House Bill 413 to remedy a unique problem in the education funding formula, which affects only Hooper Bay, which is contained within the Lower Yukon School District. Hooper Bay, which is served by the Lower Yukon School District, is unique in Alaska in having only one school in the community with an average daily membership over 425 that serves grades K to 12. Because the Lower Yukon School District recently approved and opened a charter school in Hooper Bay, the community is now seen as having two schools, which puts them in a different section of the funding formula, losing them two adjustments that cost the district about $1 million. And interestingly, both schools are in the same facility. The charter school takes up a couple of classrooms within the larger school. So they really haven't gone anywhere. The students have moved from within the community into under the umbrella of the charter school and out of the umbrella of the larger K-12 school. It is commendable that the district has found a way to expand the number of choices available to parents and families without increasing their budget, yet they have lost funding as a result. House Bill 413 adds three words to existing law, excluding charter schools. These three words allow the district to restore its full funding and remove financial disincentives in considering a charter school application. The bill has an effective date of July 1, 2022, so that the school budget is impacted at the appropriate time. The House Education Committee supports charter schools and supports Hooper Bay and the Lower Yukon School District, and we request your support in helping to make charter schools available in all parts of Alaska. Thank you for your time. We have a number of invited testifiers with expertise in this area, in this particular community. So I'm happy to step aside and let them explain the details.
Great, thank you, Rep. Drummond. Are there questions before invited testimony? Seeing none, our first testifier is Jean Stone, superintendent of the Lower Yukon School District. Mr. Stone, welcome to House Finance. If you could please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gene Stone, and I am superintendent, chief school administrator for the Lower Yukon School District. some of what I'll share in my testimony may feel repetitious, but sometimes I feel like folks need to hear it more than once. But just on behalf of the Lower Yukon School District, allow me to express the appreciation for scheduling HB 413. Lower Yukon School District is in full support of HB 413. HB 413 will remedy a funding issue that unfairly penalizes the Lower Yukon School District for opening a charter school in Hooper Bay. The penalty within the statute for adding a charter school in Hooper Bay resulted in an annual reduction in funding of $1,033,000 for fiscal year 2021 and $1,021,000 for fiscal year 2022. Until this funding penalty is remedied, LYSD will lose approximately $1 million each year. The district operates two separate educational programs in the Hooper Bay School, the conventional K-12 school and a 4-8 grade charter school that features a culturally relevant place-based learning curriculum for its students. Additionally, the school has a K-3 UPIC immersion program but is not part of the charter school and functions as part of the conventional school as a special program. Some may argue that HB 413 has a fiscal note to the state of Alaska of $1 million annually. LYSD sees the opposite. To date, our loss of foundation funding has resulted in fiscal surplus to the state of $2 million for fiscal year 21 and fiscal year 22. As a result of the Hooper Bay Charter School, our district has same number of students, the exact same students inside of the same school building, yet we realize a funding penalty of over $1 million a year. By adding the three words, excluding charter schools, to AS14.17.905, the annual funding penalty is remedied and it becomes feasible to fund Hooper Bay's charter school. As it stands now, the statute's punitive, and this unintended $1 million annual funding penalty impacts our entire school district and effectively jeopardizes rural Alaskans' access to school choice. HB 413 would remedy this funding problem and support charter school equity for rural Alaska school districts. Thank you for sponsoring and scheduling this legislation, and thank you for your time and consideration. I'm open for any questions. Thank you, Gene Stone.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Stone. We appreciate hearing from you. I see no questions. At 1:44 p.m., we were joined by Representative Thompson. Next, we will move to our room. I believe Andrew Levitt is in the room. Wonderful. Director of the Budget and Finance for the Lower Yukon School District. Welcome, Mr. Levitt. Please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Andrew Levitt. I'm the Chief Business Officer for Lower Yukon School District. I don't have any extra testimony to add, but I will be available for questions. I think Gene Stone covered everything.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming today. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me what is it specifically within the existing BSA funding formula that causes this unique problem for the Hooper Bay School in relationship to its addition of a charter school? And am I correct in understanding that if we were to adopt this particular bill, it would have no impact on any other schools throughout the state of Alaska that may have a charter school within their building?
So through the chair, the way the funding formula works, when a school in a community, let's say that's the only school in the community, when you're below 425, you get two adjustments. And then previously, so let's say through 2018, this same issue came up with Hooper Bay. When you cross the threshold from 425 to 426, you go from two adjustments to one adjustment. And that adjustment, it's about $1 million penalty. That got remedied about 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. When the charter school opened, now the funding formula looks at it and they say a charter school is technically its own school. It's a separate administration. So now you have a community that exceeds 425. So that original K-12 school, instead of getting two adjustments, gets one adjustment. And so you have a K-6 adjustment and a 7-12. Now it's just a K-12 adjustment and a charter school, and that total funding, you realize that $1 million penalty. And then as for your second question about the impact on this, the Department of Education has testified previously this is the only community that has that population level with only one K-12 school. Most of the schools that have charter schools, existing charter schools, are in communities that have multiple schools. So you might have an elementary school, middle school, high school. So it's not impacted by this. So right now, Hooper Bay is the only community that is impacted by this this current situation.
Representative Ortiz.
And just for clarification, thank you, Madam Chair. In this sense, as a school, the term school, are you really talking about a building, or are you talking about a name, I guess is what I'm saying?
Through the chair, it's when you get into the state law on what it's called facilities constituting school, the state looks at it, they say administration. So it's not the actual school building. They say, how is it administered? A charter school has a separate principal. They have the principal is beholden to the, they call it the APC, I guess, Academic Policy Committee. And so they run their own program. So even if you're inside the same school building, they say that it's a separate administration, so it counts as a separate school for funding purposes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Levitt. And our final testifier is William Nanning, a resident of Hooper Bay. I do not see him online, so we will wait to see if he comes online before we finish up. Are there questions before public testimony? Representative Wall.
Thank you. In following the thread of Representative Ortiz, I'm trying to understand the charter school within the school, both operated by the district, both in the same building, using the same facilities. I'm not opposing the bill by any stretch, but would there be another administrative workaround that would keep the same functionality but not lose the $1 million funding?
Through the chair, yes, we've looked at different options. We ran through this with Deed. One of them would be you'd have to make a separate school and split your K-12 school. You'd have to, but there's a lot of issues with that. I think Delta Junction is the only place that's happened. You'd have to kind of build a wall through your school, separate the gyms, and make it so that you have like an elementary principal and a high school principal, and they have to be completely administering their side of the building separately. It's not necessarily the building, it's the administration. The other option would be if you closed the charter school, so you'd legally extinguish it and go to a special purpose school, a school within a school, like a special program, but it's no longer a charter school. You don't have the independence of the charter school. It would fall under the administration. But those were kind of the two avenues where if you wanted to do a workaround to not change the law and restore the funding, you'd have to close the charter school.
Representative Wolf.
Yeah, so the charter school we're talking about has a separate principal, a separate theme or methodology. I mean, it's distinctly different than the same kid going to the standard school. A student can have a choice at a certain point. Do I want to go to the charter school for grades 4 through 8? Or do I want to stay in the traditional school, and then we'll have an entirely different experience?
Through the chair, that is correct. So the charter school is 4th through 8th grade, so they have their own curriculum. It's more place-based, experiential learning, and so that's kind of their curriculum. The student, if it was in 4th grade, they can pick to be part of the charter school, or they can stay as part of the traditional school.
Thank you. Representatives LeBon and then Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for joining us. A charter school embedded within a existing school, does the charter school pay some type of a lease or rent for use of that space that they're occupying?
Through the chair, so technically under state law, when a charter school is created, they are allowed to obtain space within existing school facilities if it's available. In this case, since it was existing students, there was space available, and we've allowed them to use the space inside the Hooper Bay School, and we do not charge them like a per square footage or facility usage. They are responsible for their own custodial, so like within their classrooms, cleaning up the classrooms, they do pay their own custodial. But as far as like a facility charge, the district does not allocate a charge to the charter school.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, from a economic, operational cost overhead, the charter school doesn't subtract from the district's financial picture in any way, as far as facilities.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at, I'm not sure what it's called, the document is Department of Education Early Development Facilities Constituting a School. I'm sorry, that's the bill name. It's the chart showing average daily membership. And I'm looking at fiscal year 22 membership of the Hooper Bay Charter School, 46.99. The Hooper Bay School, day school does not, that has caused the division in this community?
Through the chair, is Gene Stone would probably be the best one to address this question.
Mr. Stone?
Yes, through the chair. The answer to that is just like the many charter schools and really what the state of Alaska and many states throughout the country have done is I don't believe that I would describe it as a division of schools. I would describe it as choice. School choice is, you know, the Department of Education has advocated for choice, and so when the model was presented from a small segment of the community, but really the impetus for it or the drive for this was kind of twofold. The experiential piece was really tied to the cultural experience that people and families wanted to be able to preserve and incorporate into a school setting for their kids. Also components of the language, and I think people are, you know, familiar with. There's, you know, definitely two opinions. Some families in rural Alaska want their students to have traditional education experiences. Some send their kids to boarding schools. Some send, some people in rural Alaska participate in correspondence as a choice. There's just a number of personal reasons among families as to why they choose what they choose for their educational experience for their kids and their families. You know, when I was in the Mattson School District, we had seven different actual charter experiences and then other multiple school choice options. And so I never looked at it and, you know, still don't look at it as a division, but I just look at it as school choice. And this is really, I would say, driven by cultural and preservation of cultural values more than anything.
Thank you. And I'd like the record to reflect that Representative Carpenter did join us at 1:47 p.m. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. That would have been a trick to ask a question without actually being here. Thank you. A follow-up on that same train of question, then I guess help me understand when the Hooper Bay Charter School came into existence.
Chair, the Gene Stone again. The experience, you know, it goes back a ways. They had, I think, around 2014, the community had attempted to get a charter school organized, and then it just, you know, it takes a lot to organize it, a lot of community commitment, and then it kind of reorganized themselves and then moved forward with it in 2017, and with the application moved through the whole process. It was approved by the department, the State Board of Education, in 2018, June of actually 2020, the process started in 2018.
Representative Carpenter.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, the reason that I use the word division is because the total number of students that need to be served in Hooper Bay is a combination of the average daily membership of the Hooper Bay School and the average daily membership of the Hooper Bay Charter School. And if the reasons that 10% of the student population, their families, decided that they could no longer have their students be taught within the Hooper Bay School, and thus they organized to separate themselves from the Hooper Bay School into a Hooper Bay Charter School, and those reasons were cultural and language, that means, in reference to the previous question that Rep. Wohl asked, there was an administrative thing that possibly could have been done to meet the cultural and language needs of that 10% membership of the community, but it didn't for some reason. And thus, the community decided to begin the process in 2014, and 6 years later were successful at creating their own school for 10%. And so I think there is an administrative solution to it that that is that may may be possible. If it's only cultural and language that's causing the division, then if you were to solve the cultural and language problem, perhaps you would have all of the students under the same school and you wouldn't have the problem.
Mr. Stone?
Yeah, so I guess I, you know, would answer that with the question, is that how you would perceive all charter schools? In terms of school choice throughout the state? Just wondering if this is a philosophical question, or is this saying that administration, because the administration does provide bilingual programs throughout the district, but families with families, there's a segment there that just wants a choice. They want a place-based experience education. They want, you know, especially for that age, they've targeted that age group, and that was the design. And there's a number of place-based education types of models, not just in Alaska, but throughout the country.
Representative Carpenter.
It was meant to be a technical question. If the issue is only cultural and language, and I realize this is probably a deeper conversation for better understanding, but if there are things that can be done within the cultural and language area administratively to alleviate the concerns of the 10% of the families, then the situation resolves itself. If that's the only thing that's standing in the way of reunifying those families with the school, that's the issue that I see. We're having a similar issue all over the state of families finding that the brick-and-mortar school, the Hooper Bay school of their area, isn't meeting their needs for some reason, and they're taking their kids to homeschool, or they're taking their kids to charter schools, or they're taking them to private schools, and we're seeing an exodus from our school districts in many cases. So the question ought to be asked of the Hooper Bay School and that school district, what is it administratively that is going to keep these kids in your school that is going to solve this problem? Because it's a problem, it's a systemic problem all through the state.
Mr. Stone?
Yeah, through the chair, I would best explain it as in terms of the cultural piece. Yes, we've worked and we've enhanced within our strategic plan, enhanced the cultural offerings, bolstered our bilingual programs, and we've done a number of those types of things. The one thing that does occur when you have a charter school is federally, you can, and at the state level, you can often infuse your programs with some different grant opportunities, and that's a little different sometimes than a special mission school because it's operating under the umbrella of the district within a special mission school. And sometimes communities, they just want to have a charter school. They want to have that local control piece, and they feel like they should have that opportunity given, you know, the number of other districts throughout the state that have, and many of them very successfully, have created charter schools and operated within that context of school choice. There are also some benefits. I see that some of the districts like Anchorage and Mat-Su, especially in crowding in districts, don't necessarily have to bond for buildings. Part of the revenue is used for facilities and other and for the building space required for the charter school. So there is some relief sometimes in terms of not necessarily in this situation because they in Hooper Bay we don't have a building, but they share a building with us. But I believe that it just comes down to that, you know, part, and it's something that's been provided through statute, is the ability to offer choice.
Follow up.
Yes, follow up.
So I'm assuming that the kids in the charter school get a comparable education to the kids that are in the Hooper Bay School. And it would be my just assumption that having a unified school would be of most benefit to the community. Has there been any discussion about just turning the entire population into a Hooper Bay charter school, and so that you've got a combined population under a charter school?
Mr. Stone?
That conversation, again, the model is a 4-8, and so at this time that really hasn't happened. The Hooper Bay School has a traditional K-12 for the majority of students is what's offered. It's, the current model is to serve 4-8. One of the things that we have done is we have we bought the old Longhouse Hotel in Anchorage. That's a career tech offering, and so that's an option for our high school kids to be able to go in 9-week increments. They do online learning at the boarding facility, and then for half a day, and then the other half they go over to Anchorage School District and take some kind of CTE or vocational course at King Tech High School, and that instruction is delivered by Anchorage School District's educators there. So that, we're addressing what we think are, needs that have been expressed by the community and the school, but it's not a one-size-fits-all with what the 4-8 model is.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, Madam Co-Chair. I think there's a solution out there, and the bill is kind of a Band-Aid. I'm going to continue to ask questions. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Representatives Ortiz and Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess kind of continued follow-up on some of the questions we've heard so far from the two previous question askers. And full disclosure, before I came into this particular position, part of my career in education was actually a charter school principal. And we, in that situation, we existed in one building, two different charter schools in one building, two different philosophies, two different approaches to learning, if you will. And we had to keep up the enrollment numbers, and that was accomplished differently by the two different charter schools. The one charter school that I was not administrator of was K-8. Mine was K-6, but we offered some other things that, attracted people to the building, kept our enrollment up. My question is, and so I'm familiar with the enrollment requirement that's there as a part of qualifying for, quote, full funding for a particular school. And we had a border in our school. We had the one school, we were fully separated. It was a built-in border, so the one school was on one side of the building, the other school was on the other side of the building. But we did share gym and things like that. My question, I guess, is what is it unique about this situation, which doesn't allow you to exist within the framework of the current BSA formula, exist at the funding level that you'd like to see, that's different from my experience that I just described to you?
So through the chair, I'll take that one. The unique part, so most of the let's say, rural schools in the rural areas where you have a smaller community, there's for efficiencies, it's just one school, a K-12 school. And so that's what's unique about this one, where if there was, let's just say, hypothetically speaking here, let's just say in Hooper Bay you had a K-6 school and then a 7-12 school and then a charter school, this wouldn't be an issue because that there would be a K-6 adjustment for the K-6 school, a 7-12 for that other school, or however you decided to break the grades, and then you'd have the charter school, and that would get its own funding. This is unique because it's a single community, single site that has one K-12 school, and so that's when you follow the formula, that's where it gets tripped up. Because if you go back to only having one facility, so you could say that one school, the funding level is you get two adjustments, higher funding. Now that you have two schools, the charter school's there, charter school gets the charter school funding. The remaining school, the existing Hooper Bay School, that's where it generates that $1 million penalty because it's one singular K through 12 school. And so, again, if you were to build a separate school building, you'd have a separate school. It wouldn't be a problem. In other places, larger cities, like you could say Anchorage, I don't know how many schools are in Anchorage, but it's more than one. And so you don't have that problem. Same thing with most charter schools exist in larger urban areas where you're able to pull parents that are very interested in one type of learning. And that community already has multiple schools, so you don't get tripped up on this form. It's only when you have one community with one single school for the whole grade span that this becomes an issue over the population threshold student and total student enrollment of 425. So it's very specific, very unique, just to Hooper Bay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edgeman.
Yeah, so is it 425 plus discrete students, or is it ADM, 425 ADM students?
Through the chair, ADM 425. So Hooper Bay has around, I think, 480 in total, roughly, give or take. We don't have any correspondence or any of that. So it's actual, the ADM is the actual student enrollment.
480 students?
Yeah, about that. Yeah, it goes up and down, but something around there.
And through the co-chair, to put that in perspective, my hometown of Dillingham is 2,400 people with 420 students. So just off the cuff, 480 students for a town of about 1,400 soaking wet. I bet is probably the highest concentration of students to the actual population of the community in Alaska. I'm not asking that question for now anyway. But my question would be, what are your class sizes, and what does this do in terms of being able to provide a quality education, and does that $1 million hit really register more than it might in a bigger school with a smaller classroom size?
So, Gene, I don't know if you want to take the first pass about the classroom size.
Mr. Stone?
Yeah. Through the chair. So, depending upon, you know, our grade levels, but our elementary schools are averaging right around 2,300 per classroom. Middle school is around 24. High school is about roughly 20 per class size. So the the PTR on it is not unreasonable. That's really not a necessarily the issue for us right now. It was a new school built in 2006, I believe, is when it opened, and it does a reasonably good job in terms of keeping pace with that. But that's where it sits with class size.
Representative Edgeman.
The charter school is a little bit smaller. The charter school's average is about a 15 PTR.
So I just, through the co-chair, want to speak in support of the bill. If we wanted to do a full forensic sort of analysis of other charter schools, I'm just thinking off the top of my head that roughly speaking, that the Matsu Valley has like 48 schools. A lot of those are charter schools. And I know Anchorage has a lot of charter schools. There are charter schools everywhere. So until somebody can point to me that there's a violation of the law or there's some kind of impropriety taking place, this is the way it operates in Alaska, and I think we should pass this bill.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm not trying to rewrite any laws here, and I'm happy to pass this one too. It's an interesting discussion, one that we haven't really had here too much about, and I'd be thrilled to do deeper dive on charter schools because I don't really understand how it works. Fairbanks has a bunch and they keep popping up, and I know the district is mandated to fund them. If they can find the space, they pay for the staff, is my understanding. I think the space is paid for by the school, and again, I'm no I guess my question, so the BSA formula is weird idiosyncrasy with this district, that it loses a bunch of BSA funding with this charter school. So that's why we have this bill in front of us. It's $1 million. The PTR, pupil teacher ratio, is actually way better than my kid's school at Fairbanks, that's for sure. She's over 30 in the class with one teacher, so this school has a much better PTR than Fairbanks. It was mentioned there's between 40 and 50, I guess, in the charter school, five grades, and he said it's a PTR 15, so I'm assuming that's three teachers for five grades, principal, custodial, and teacher aides. I don't know what other staff. And this is a more of a charter school question, but since we're talking about it, does the BSA for the kids in the charter school, does that support the charter school? Is that separated off, or does the district just have BSA money to spend as they wish? And is it, I mean, could the charter school have twice as many staff and it would still be okay, or is it directed by the formula, and is it sort of separated from the regular school financially through the BSA number?
Thank you, Representative Wohl. And it was suggested that we go to Elwin Blackwell, the school finance manager at the Department of Education and Early Development. Mr. Blackwell, are you available?
Yes, I am. I'm here online.
Could you place yourself on the record and help Representative Wohl with this question?
Yes, this is Elwin Blackwell with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. To answer, through the chair, to answer Representative Wohl's question, the way these statutes, yes, the charter school ends up getting an adjustment as they go through the foundation program, but the way the charter school statutes are written, all funding that is generated by that charter school has to be given to the charter school for their administration and funding. There could be some, through the agreement between the charter school and the school district, there could be some monies that would be retained by the school district for some general administrative purposes, like an overhead, but that would be part of the charter agreement between the charter school and the district. So though the charter school does generate funding through the foundation funding formula, all that funding has to go to the charter school to operate that program. And I hope that has answered the representative's question. If I've missed something, please let me know.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you. I think you answered half the question, or half of my question, which was, you're saying all the foundation formula that goes to the charter school has to stay in the charter school. Is that all they get? In other words, if they're short, can they say to the rest of the district, which I guess is the other school, or to the district itself, can they say, well, the BSA formula based on the number of students doesn't cover our costs? So I realize all that formula funding stays in the charter school, but if it's insufficient, is that on them, or is there a relief?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, this is Elwin Blackwell again. I don't know the exact answer to that question. I'm going to make the assumption that would be a discussion between the charter school and the district administration if the charter school found that they had insufficient funding. The way the statute's written, it would be on the charter school, but I could see a district perhaps giving a little additional money if they needed it, but that would certainly be up to the school district to make that determination.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, for you, sir, the charter school formed in 2020, and we're into FY23 in about a month and a half. So were you short $1 million in FY21 and 22?
Through the chair, that is correct. So FY21, it was a little over $1 million. FY22, so the current fiscal year we're in right now, also $1 million. So cumulative, about a $2 million loss in funding.
Representative Josephson.
What is the total grant you get from the state for the LYSD?
So, Through the chair, so you asked total state funding all in? I believe it's around $55 million. That's total, so everything, and I think the state foundation funding component of that is around $35
million. If all,
so you lost 2 to 3% of your funding, and you managed to get by somehow?
Through the chair, yes, so it goes into, so that the district will have every year, you know, you put your budget together and your reserve, so it comes out of your, you have to make cuts. So we've cut back on staff, so you cut back on the teachers, and then the rest of it, any loss on that comes out of the any reserve, so you start depleting your reserves.
I just would say, you know, if I were King Brittany, I'd want to make you whole. That's what I would do. You know, to the extent you've survived the experience and are okay, then I wouldn't, I guess. But to the extent you need to restore staff or you needed new supplies, you didn't get them, that's what I would do. To me, this is just a technical fix. And I don't know how to help you with that, but I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. I know how we can help, and that is pass this bill. I just wanted to be on the record as not only supporting this, but thanking Representative Drummond as well as the House Education Committee for carrying this bill. Hooper Bay is in my school, in my district. It's in the Lower Yukon School District. And I think just to maybe add on to what you're saying, you know, it is a little bit of a technical fix because it just fixes this situation where you've just got a structure change, but you know, all things being equal, you know, they're now being cut $1 million, which is pretty substantial. And I did have a question, Mr. Levitt. You said it was $55 million, and that was for the number of schools in that school district is?
So through the chair, we have 10 schools plus the charter school plus the Kuzlovac Career Academy.
Great, thank you. So are there any other further questions? Representative Carpenter?
Mr. Co-Chair, I don't particularly have another question. I would like to, in the limited conversations that I've had here, support the need here, support the bill. I think that charter schools are an important part of our school system. They fill a need and are probably the way of the future.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? I don't see any. So with that, the next item on our agenda, I believe, are the fiscal notes. Actually, we'll go back and see if Mr. Nanning is online, and I do not see him online. So with that, we'll go over to the fiscal notes. And I should say it sounds, I think we're still in, I guess we'll open public testimony. And public testimony is open on this bill. Is there anybody in the room or online who would like to testify? And I don't see anyone. So with that, we'll go ahead and close public testimony on HB 413. And we'll go over to the fiscal notes. Elwin Blackwell, if you could put yourself on the record and just review the two fiscal notes that we have before us. And the first one is control code RDDLO, and it's from the K through 12 Aid to School Districts Foundation Program Allocation. Mr. Blackwell, are you there?
Yes, I am. This is Elwin Blackwell, School Finance Manager, for the record. Yes, so for component number, OMB component number 141, this is the one for the appropriation of K-12 aid to school districts. This particular fiscal note, though it shows a zero, is provided for informational or explanatory purposes only. Since funding doesn't actually go out of or isn't paid out of the foundation funding program, we provide this fiscal note just to show that it affects the foundation program, but this is not where the actual funding will be paid out. So this is just for explanation purposes, this fiscal note. That's why it's a zero. If we end up moving to fiscal note, the fiscal note with OMB component number 2804, this is the capitalization of the public education fund, so the transfer from the general fund into the public education fund. We have a fiscal note based on FY23 projected numbers of an additional amount of $1,082,700 is what would be needed to fund this bill in FY23. And for any out years, once this bill would be enacted. I think most of the explanation as to what this bill does has been addressed already. If there's any other questions on the fiscal notes, I would be more than willing to answer them.
Okay, do we have any questions regarding fiscal notes? Representative Rasmussen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the chair. I just wanted to verify that this funding on the second fiscal note doesn't stand any risk in a possible reverse sweep scenario. The money would go straight from the general fund out to the district. Is that correct?
This is Ellen Blackwell, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. The general fund deposit into the public education fund, my understanding is that public education fund is not a sweepable fund, so once that money goes into the public education fund, it remains there. We make payments out to school districts based on the foundation allocation out of the public education fund once that general fund money has been deposited into that fund.
Thank you.
Does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. I see no further questions on the fiscal notes. So with that, it looks like we will go ahead and, oh, Representative Carpenter?
Thank you. Mr. Pritchard, do we by chance have legal on the line?
I do not see legal online. Let me check on the other bill to see if maybe there's anybody there. Is there anybody online from legal? I don't believe so. No, I don't see anyone.
Let me ask a question. Maybe somebody in the room or on the phone can answer it. If you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Sure, absolutely.
So I'm looking in the statute. This is 1417905-3, and it references an alternative school. For the sake of the statute, is an alternative school synonymous with a charter school, or do they have separate technical definitions?
Does anybody want to take a stab at that? And if not, we're going to set the bill aside, so we'll have some time to look into that and maybe reach out to legal if I don't see anybody who's wanting to jump at that. So with that, if we could maybe take note of that question, and we'll check with legal. We'll have staff do that. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set aside HB 413. Looks like there's going to be an amendment deadline set for Monday, May 2nd at noon. And so if there's nothing else to come for us for this, I think the Representative Drummond is also here for the next bill before us. So we'll go ahead and jump right into that. And that's an introduction of House Bill 350, which is a school bond debt reimbursement bill. And so Representative, we could have both you as well as your staff, Sarah Evans, put yourself on the record again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is always a pleasure to be in front of House Finance. I haven't been here in a while, since maybe 50 seconds or so. And I'm happy to carry this this bill. Again, I'm Harriet Drummond, representing House District 18 in Anchorage. Includes the great neighborhoods of Huntington Park, Forest Park, North Star, Rogers Park, Anchor Park, Geneva Woods, Midtown Business District, and the Independent Republic of Spinard. There are five physical school buildings in my district, but at last count, I have at least 14 school attendance areas that kids in my district go to. They may be just outside the boundaries of my district or a mile or two away in the case of East High School, and Wendler Middle School, but the kids in my district don't stay within the district necessarily, go to the physical schools that are in my district. But I'm not here representing simply the needs of those five physical schools in my district, and not even the needs of Anchorage's 90-plus schools, but all of Alaska schools. We have over 500 physical schools scattered throughout the state, in every community, and the decisions that we make here impact every one of those schools. Starting in 2015, as a result of the passage of Senate Bill 64, the state of Alaska stopped reimbursing new school bond debt approved by the voters of about 20 school districts around the state because the state was suffering serious revenue shortfalls. The state has, however, continued to pay down the debt from school bonds passed in years prior to 2015. I was in the House in 2015, along with some of you, and worked really hard to try to stop that bill from retroactively impacting the school bonds in Anchorage, as this bill, Senate Bill 64, passed just a few days before Election Day in Anchorage, but it had a retroactive date of January 1st, 2015, so if it passed, it would have impacted, and it did impact Anchorage's bond. The bond issue that passed a few days later in Anchorage was not reimbursed by the state, and the voters of Anchorage, the taxpayers of Anchorage, are responsible for the full cost of those bonds. Typically, Anchorage bond issues have been a combination of major maintenance funds and major maintenance projects and new construction or additions, and they were reimbursed at about 65%, a balance of 60 and 70% by the state prior to 2015. Now, Anchorage taxpayers are paying the whole 100% instead of 35% as they would have before. And in 2020, since the state was still having serious revenue issues, House Bill 106 extended this school bond debt reimbursement moratorium to 2025. School bonds, as you know, are critically important to school districts to help build new schools and keep older facilities running. Bonds pay for a variety of construction and maintenance projects, such as new boilers, roof replacements, security improvements, and more. School districts spend a substantial amount on regular maintenance out of their operating budgets to keep their buildings in good repair and their students and staff in safe and healthy buildings. But as schools age and thousands of kids and staff troop in and out of them every day, things wear out, day-to-day maintenance just can't cover the needs adequately. And so districts have to bring forward carefully considered bond issues to their voters, developed in consultation with their school communities, as well as with their local governing assemblies or city councils. Currently, the school bond debt moratorium is set to end on July 1st, 2025. House Bill 350 would change that to end this July 1st, 2022, and school districts could again count on help from the state to help pay for school bond debt and save their taxpayers' money. The 2015 legislation decreased the rate also that the state reimbursed communities to 40 and 50%, depending on whether the bonds covered new construction or major maintenance. House Bill 350 seeks to increase the reimbursable school bond debt back to the original 60 to 70% from the state. Alaska taxpayers and school districts can no longer afford to pay the full price for much needed maintenance. Construction costs have been skyrocketing. As you may know, there was a big bond issue on Anchorage's ballot here a few weeks ago, and it failed by a very small percentage. But it included $31 million for an elementary school of about 280 kids. This was the oldest school in the district currently, and it was not cost-effective to keep patching that building, and it just needed to be entirely replaced. In my time on the Anchorage School Board in the 90s, we were building elementary schools for $10 to $12 million. It is shocking to me that 25 years later, it costs three times as much to build an elementary school. And this one is smaller than the average elementary school. The average elementary school in Anchorage has a capacity of 500 to 550 kids. So this, as we all know, the cost of construction is huge. So to me, backing off to 40 and 50% reimbursement doesn't make sense either in terms of the increased cost. My district, and I just don't just mean House District 18, but Anchorage's entire school district from Girdwood to Eklutna and from East Anchorage to the Cook Inlet, has continued to approve school bonds since 2015, as we know that our community's investment in their schools needs to be protected. But the Anchorage School District has had to limit its new bond issues to no more than the older bond debt that has been retired, and gone to putting school bonds on the ballot every 2 years instead of every year. Some bonds have failed in that time period, but the needs don't go away. The Anchorage School District has over 90 facilities, and they're still aging and wearing out as thousands of kids and staff use them intensively every day. And there are over 500 school facilities among the 54 districts in our state. They all suffer from similar maintenance issues, and some simply need to be replaced with new schools, as some of the older schools are simply uneconomic to keep repairing. The Institute of Social and Economic Research at UA studied this issue in 2021. They found that Alaska is underfunding school maintenance, and school districts are falling behind big time in addressing maintenance problems. ICER noted that since the moratorium started in 2015, only Anchorage and the North Slope Borough have approved new school bonds. They note that the National Council on School Facilities recommends that states annually spend 4% of the state's total school replacement value annually on capital projects to keep up. Alaska currently spends only about 2.6% of that school replacement value, and school facilities are simply falling behind. The legislature is mandated to spend a certain amount of funding on rural schools where communities do not have taxing authority. So those schools are guaranteed a certain minimum amount of funding. But municipalities don't have that kind of guarantee, and so are falling behind. And I'd like to close my introduction with the reminding you of our constitutional obligation. Article 7, Health, Education, and Welfare, Section 1, Public Education. The legislature shall by general law establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state. That doesn't just mean we pay for teachers. It doesn't just mean we transport kids to school. It doesn't mean we make sure that they're fed. Make sure that we just cover curriculum and textbooks, but it also means the buildings. That is what I refer to as a system of schools. And so please consider passing this bill, approving this bill, so that schools can go back to working with the state to help get funding from the state to pass their essential school bond issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Drummond. Are there questions before invited testimony? Representative Josephson.
Yes. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Drummond. I think, candidly, the odds of my supporting this bill are well above 90%. I do, if you could help remind me, the number that I see frequently on the pay down of school bond debt, when it's not vetoed, has hovered around sort of $60 to $75 million, not including the REAAs. My question is, what would it be? Would it still be in that range, or would it be greater? In other words, prior to the 2014 recession, was the outlay annually larger than $60 to $80 million, do you know?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I apologize for not having that history for you. I will bring it next time this bill is heard. My guess is that the demand is so pent up since 2015. And in 2015, you may have a chart in your packet that shows the 21 different school districts that had bond issues in various states of repayment. Only two of those school districts have been passing bond issues since then. And that's Anchorage and the North Slope Borough. So the demand is there. As I said, schools continue to wear out, and communities need help paying for them.
Representative Josephson.
Just a quick comment. It's apropos that Representative Rasmussen's grandmother is here, the father of the tax man. I can't say that I know a whole lot about this, but to stay under that cap, we need state assistance. And so many of these things go back to
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. If I could, having been an Anchorage Municipal Assembly member, when bond issues like this pass in Anchorage, whether it be for schools or fire department needs or roads, the tax increases are the line on the ballot says that the tax cap will increase to accommodate the taxes that the voters have approved with this ballot issue. The other thing that is normally taken into consideration is how much in bonded indebtedness has been retired in the prior year. Quite often, say the school district passes a $55 million bond issue, they will have retired $55 million. That's what Anchorage generally retires in its last few years of bond issues. So generally, they'll replace one with the other. But if there's a substantial increase, any increase lifts the tax cap to allow that increase when the voters have approved it.
Thank you. And we will move to our first of five invited testifiers this afternoon. We have Elwin Blackwell from earlier, the school finance manager with the Department of Education and Early Development. Welcome again. If you could place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Well, this is Elwin Blackwell with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. I didn't necessarily have any testimony other than I was here to answer any questions. And I did hear the question from the representative earlier about the history of the debt reimbursement program. And what has been funded in the past. Yes, currently we are at about $75 million in that neighborhood for reimbursement under the program. But back when the program was shut down, we were, or was sunsetted, I should say, for any new indebtedness, voter-approved indebtedness, the annual reimbursement was in excess of $100 million. So in that time frame, we have seen older bonds pay off, no new bonds coming into the pipeline, so that overall the debt reimbursement program has seen a decrease in the amount of annual appropriation to meet that need. If this bill if this bill came into effect, it would take a few years, but it's reasonable to expect, based on past history, that you could see that grow again from that $75 million mark that we're currently at up into maybe $80, $90, $100 million over time. But that would be my answer to Representative Josephson, I think, who asked that question.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here, and we will come back to you regarding the fiscal note in just a bit. Next is Jim Anderson, Chief Financial Officer with the Anchorage School District. Welcome, Mr. Anderson. Please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you and good afternoon. My name is Jim Anderson. I'm the Chief Finance Officer for Anchorage School District, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 350. So from FY 17 through 22, the governor vetoed a little over $83 million in state bond debt reimbursement for bonds that were approved prior to 2015. And that was a burden on top of the Anchorage residents picking up 100% for all new bond debt starting in January of that year. ASD operates and maintains one of the largest physical plants of any public entity in the state. It's really us and the University of Alaska. We have 91 facilities worth approximately $2 billion. The average age of our facilities is 36 years old, including 28 facilities over 50 years old and 12 facilities over 60 years old or more. So about 12 years ago, ASD had $100 million in deferred maintenance. We currently have over $800 million in deferred maintenance, and it's growing about at the rate that Representative Drummond mentioned earlier, in the 3-4% per year. So the moratoriums on state bond debt reimbursement plus the 4 years of cost shifting, they have had a significant impact on our ability to sustain our facilities through bonding. I think many, if not most of you, are aware that we we recently had a two-year bond for just over $111 million rejected by the Anchorage residents during this month's election. When Representative Drummond mentioned the 4%, for us that's about $80 million per year. We have never been able to pass a bond really even close to that, and that's what really explains why our deferred maintenance has gone up, because we've always tried to pay off more than what we bond. And what that doesn't take into account is the money that you're paying off for bonds as old as 20 years old, that you're finally paying the last payments, the value of what that bond was worth 20 years prior is not the same as what it would cost to do the same thing in 2022. So we're not just staying below what we pay off, but we've been staying below what we've been paying off and adding inflationary costs. So we get less and less every single year that we do a bond by using that as the architecture for developing bonds. So House Bill 350 naturally does restart bond debt reimbursement in July of this year. I think it would be a welcome relief to the Anchorage taxpayers, and certainly would reset conditions that would allow us to feel more comfortable taking a bond to the public and feeling more optimistic that they'd be able to pass it. So thank you for your time, and if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the Chair, thank you for being here today. Mr. Anderson, appreciate your testimony. I was curious, could you tell us what the physical footprint of ASD as far as overall square footage now compared to 20 years ago?
I can get that information and provide it to the committee. Oh, I'm sorry, through the co-chair to Representative Rasmussen. I can get that information and provide it to the committee this afternoon. I don't have that memorized. I apologize.
No problem. Through the chair, if I could follow up.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And then could you get us a list of the attendance numbers for, I guess, average daily membership for ASD over the last 10 or 20 years, if you have that?
Through the co-chair, to Representative Rasmussen, absolutely, I will provide that as well to the committee.
Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. We appreciate you calling in, Mr. Anderson. Next, we have Dr. Lisa Parody, the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Welcome to House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Lisa Skiles Parody, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators, or ACSA. We are a nonprofit organization established in 1973 to serve as an umbrella for some of Alaska's premier educational leadership organizations, including Alaska Superintendents Association, the Alaska Association of Secondary School Principals, the Alaska Association of Elementary School Principals, the Alaska School Business Officials, and all the hardworking school administrators across Alaska. I want to echo the remarks of Representative Drummond and Jim Anderson, one of our members, and will speak directly to our support of House Bill number 350. Thank you also to Representative Drummond Tarnfield for bringing the bill. Each year, our members work together to develop what are called the Joint Position Statements. The Joint Position Statements envelop the highest priorities for education policy positions. School safety is one of our priorities in this year's Joint Position Statement. ACSA supports improving the safety, physical, and mental well-being of our children, knowing that this is critical to increasing student achievement. ACSA supports funding for school capital projects and major maintenance for existing school district facilities in order to provide students a safe and healthy learning environment. In 2019, 44% of schools were over 40 years old, and 59 buildings were over 60 years old. earlier this year, ACSA conducted a survey of capital funding needs for Alaska schools. Of the 38 districts who completed the survey, 10 of the districts reported major maintenance needs ranging from 1 to 10 million, and 7 districts reported major maintenance needs from 10 to 100 million. When asked why they don't request funds from the state, 61% of the school districts responded saying there is no point since most of the projects aren't funding, and the cost of completing an application can range to $10,000 per application, as well as their lack of capacity to complete the application. My notes from 2019 show that as there's a maintenance backlog of $206 million, and we know that that number is higher now since many of the projects are not represented on the Department of Education Early Development list. The school districts also reported on the specific projects that needed funding. One of the districts shared the need for a new heating system and that they had had to close for 2 days because they didn't have heat. Imagine a school building built in 1965. Another district shared that their building built in 1965 needed to be upgraded to address the changing needs of the school. Think about HVAC, recognizing what has changed in technology, all the pieces that we understand about the importance of providing a safe building for our students to learn. Another district shared that students are in a building that is simply unsafe, yet there is no other place to have them learn. Since the school bond debt moratorium was implemented in 2015, many school districts have been deferring their major maintenance needs, as you heard from Mr. Anderson. According to an ICER report that Representative Drummond referred to from 2021, in FY 2000 to 2014, Alaska spent an average of $300 billion on K-12 capital spending. From FY 2015 to 2020, spending was $124 billion. The National Council on School Facilities suggests that spending for Alaska schools should be $374 million for essential maintenance for our schools. In 2019, 21 boroughs had bond debt totaling $1 billion. By sunsetting the school bond debt moratorium to July 2022, and changing the reimbursement amount for major maintenance by 20%, as proposed in House Bill 350. This will help alleviate the burden of needed maintenance projects in our school and help ensure Alaska students have a safe and current learning environment. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your consideration of this bill.
Thank you very much, Dr. Parody. We appreciate you being here. Next up is Nils Andreasen, the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Welcome to House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi. For the record, this is Nils Andreasen. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. The school bond debt reimbursement program is certainly of interest to AML members who actively participate in that program or have in the past. I meant to be available for questions, but could add some thoughts in terms of testimony. I think to the previous testifier's point about the value or the return on investment that school districts or local governments get in applying to the state at this point, it's worth knowing that when we look back over the last 10 to 20 years for school districts that submit projects to the state, there's an 8% chance that they're funded. One of the big reasons to have in place a school bond debt reimbursement program is that while it was functioning effectively, while the state was fully reimbursing those costs, you saw less competition in the maintenance and construction grant program. You saw greater partnership between local government and the state. And you had fairly effective and efficient processes for tackling the state's obligation to fund public education and in the provision of these facilities. I think as you look to the future, a good starting point is the six-year plan. Every district is required to have a, and local governments responsible for school districts required to have a CIP list, required to have a planning process in place for identifying their capital needs related to school infrastructure. The value of the current FY23 six-year plan rests at about $1.42 billion. And the question in my mind for this body and for the state is how it wants to fulfill the, its obligation to meeting that need over at least the next 6 years, and recognizing that many districts don't submit to that list because it's not cost effective for them to do so. That list, if it were taken just on the average of requests from school districts and local governments over the last 10 years, should be more like $2.5 billion. That's probably the number that you're really wrestling with. Removing the moratorium on school bond debt reimbursement opened up another tool in the toolbox. It takes less pressure. It takes pressure off the school construction and major maintenance grant program. It takes pressure off school districts who are trying to figure out how to balance very limited resources and declining resources really over time for performance and teachers and facilities and how to work out where limited resources should be deployed in those circumstances. I will say, and I think one of the reasons to participate today is, you know, there's certainly some sensitivity at this point with regard to this program. For the last few years, it has faced an uncertain funding status, and the failure to reimburse in some of those years has meant that there's little trust amongst local governments that the state would fulfill future obligations. And while we would welcome, and I think members support, removal of the moratorium and would welcome additional tools to meet their needs of school districts, it remains true that each would approach future opportunities cautiously. And I think that's worth kind of knowing and working through. With that, I'll close my testimony and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Andreessen. We appreciate you calling in today. Our final testifier is Peter Hoppner, President of the Association of Alaska School Boards. Welcome to House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you very much. Yes, I am Peter Hoppner. I'm on the Cordova School Board and currently the President of the Alaska Association of School Boards. I appreciate the House Finance Committee for taking testimony in House Bill 350 and for Representative Drummond for bringing this bill forward and attempting to stop the ban or moratorium on school bond debt reimbursement, the ability of local school districts bonding and reimbursement from the state. The Alaska Association of School Boards also has a resolution in support of this legislation. We all know that banning things doesn't work, as evident from the beginnings of time and God telling Adam and Eve not to eat an apple. We saw what happened there. Similarly, banning or stopping school construction does no good. Kicking the can down the road does not solve any issues. We need solution-based ideas. School building needs don't change. If you needed a school replaced 7 years ago, the problem doesn't go away. It just costs more. The 7 years that this moratorium has been in place has seen costs skyrocket beyond anything that we can imagine. So not only is there a delay and students not in a healthy learning environment, maintenance personnel are holding things together with hose clamps, duct tape, and bubble gum, wasting their time trying to maintain failing systems, like our high school in Cordova, built in 1965, 57 years old. I also appreciate returning the reimbursement levels to a 60 and 70% rate from prior to this ban or moratorium that was put in place. Additionally, the state needs to be held to their promise of the reimbursement also, as Cordova has seen the fallout from this cost shifting of state obligations that are passed on to local communities that voted for bonds knowing that the state would honor their obligations. And when Cordova was handed a $1.5 million bill, they reduced the local contribution to education. It is just wrong in so many ways for the state to sidestep their obligations. I often wonder why is the state doing this to communities? Are not our children the future? Does the state want to have a detrimental effect on education? Also, are people losing faith in the state of Alaska when the state fails to meet their obligations? And as Nils just mentioned, I don't want the Alaskans to lose faith and trust in the state of Alaska. I just wish there were some teeth in this bill that would assure constituents that the state will meet their obligations. I truly appreciate time and consideration for this bill, House Bill 350. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoppner. We appreciate your testimony today. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Hoppner, thank you for calling in. I'd like to ask a question or two, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Lebon.
Regarding Cordova, you mentioned your school facility was constructed back in 1965. Was that constructed through financing by a voter-approved bond issue?
Oh, boy. That was before my time. I'm not certain on that. I couldn't give you an answer on that one. We just we redid our elementary school, which was even older in my tenure on the board, but we did the voters approved it 85%. That building was built in 1958, wasn't earthquake proof. It was renovated. It's a wonderful environment for the children to be in at this point. But unfortunately, when the school bond debt reimbursement was taken away, our community, you know, it was such a hit. I mean, it's like when you go into the bank and they say, well, we need $100,000 tomorrow or you're going to have to move out. So when our community all of a sudden was hit with a $1.5 million bill, when their contribution to education is around $2 million, they had to back off of education funding, which is tremendously disappointing. So the unintended consequences of not meeting the obligations, what the voters believed they were voting for, came through. That was interesting and disappointing, I guess, is one word.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. And just from a philosophical point of view in Cordova, if the school needed some capital maintenance or repair, would the community expect to go to a vote of the citizens for a bond issue, or would you look toward the state of Alaska to help pay for that?
No, we would go to a bond issue. That's what we're looking at. We're going to start developing to do that again. We looked at that, the CIP list previously with doing the elementary school, and there's no way to move up that list. We sat on the list way down, waited for years. And I believe one of the previous testifiers mentioned about that, you know, there's no way of getting any building built through the CIP list. There's way too many other needs in other districts that can't bond. We're very fortunate here in Cordova to be able to bond out. But as I say, I do have concerns that from the past experiences with the school bond debt not being reversed, you know, the failed obligations, what will the constituents feel the next time they vote? That's a great concern I have, and I don't want to lose the faith that I have in the state of Alaska.
Representative Lebon.
One last follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. And so looking ahead, if the community felt that the school facility needed to be upgraded, repaired, renovated, whatever, and it went to a bond issue, would the community, if they did support the bond issue, would it feel that the catalyst for the support would be dependent upon this bill passing and getting some level of reimbursement, or would the community address the need and just move forward? And maybe that's speculation, and it's impossible to know which way the community might lean on that. Or do you have a little bit of insight to help me with what Cordova might do if this bill does not pass?
Well, if this bill doesn't pass, you know, it, as I said, it further kicks the issue down the road. And you know, the longer a person waits, construction costs go up. That's one of the issues, as well as the 40 to 50% funding rate that's on this bill right now is just so detrimental that it wouldn't, I would, you know, that makes it a huge burden on our community. The previous election, it was 85%. It was just an astounding show of support for students in Cordova, our children. The community of Cordova does value education and educating their students, so there is support for students. And I would hope we could get this passed this year, open it up for the schools around the state of Alaska, and maintain that funding rate of 60 to 70%.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Hoppner. We appreciate you being with us today. And finally, we will go over the fiscal note, control code CYLQT, and we'll go back to Mr. Blackwell.
Yes, this is Ellen Blackwell, the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. So to go over this fiscal note, it would be OMB component number 153. This fiscal note is an indeterminate fiscal note. It is indeterminate because the department does not know how many municipalities will go out to vote, how much they would seek voter approval, and when they might sell the bonds. We do anticipate that there would be some municipalities that would go out and issue debt. Since this fiscal note was put together, we have heard that there are three municipalities that may be looking at going out to their voters this fall. It would be Kenai, Ketchikan, and Mat-Su. So there are municipalities out there looking at potentially going out to their voters this fall to get voter approval for bonds. What this bill does is that it would change and reopen the debt reimbursement program that's listed in AS 1411-100. It would open it up effective July 1st, 2022. It would also change the statute in AS 1411-100A19, which currently has this program reimbursing at 40 and 50% when it reopens in 2025. It would change those reimbursement rates to 60 and 70% as they were before the program was sunsetted. The earliest any bond debt would start to show up in the department's budget would be fiscal year 2024. The reason for that is in AS 1411-102, municipalities need to notify the department of their request for allocation by October 15th. So if a district goes out and sells their bonds, or I should say, let me back up. If a municipality goes out and gets voter approval this October, they could then notify us that they had voter approval on bonds. They could include that on their request for allocation. And that request for allocation then would help fund FY 2024. That's what we would use to build our FY 2024 budget. So the first year that we could see any debt showing up into this program, if this bill were to pass, would be in FY 2024.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Blackwell. Representative Wool and then Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I see that there's two reimbursement rates, 60 or 70. one is new and one is maintenance. Is the lower number for new construction?
Yes, this is Owen Blackwell, through the chair. The differences between the two different reimbursement rates, at 70%, if you have a major maintenance project, you would qualify under the 70%. You can get new construction under the 70% if you qualify for the space that you're asking for. If you do not qualify for the space based on the department's space guidelines, then you can still get the project approved, but we will only participate at 60%.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess based on the testimony that we heard earlier, that maintenance in Anchorage School District, for example, is, I want to say, $800 million? Is that what the number I heard? Is that $800 million? And if there was a 60 to 70% reimbursement from the state, would that create a major bond sale, a yard sale, garage sale? In other words, would all these school districts go, wow, we can get 70% reimbursement, let's have a bond sale, and it would cascade? And does the fiscal note, do you have any projections for what that would, I see a lot of zeros here, but, and I know you can't predict, I'm just wondering what the effect would be if suddenly the reimbursement rate were to go up, and obviously a lot of major maintenance has been deferred. What do you think the implications of that would be?
Mr. Blackwell?
Yes, this is Owen Blackwell, and through the chair, I don't have any real projection as to what it would look like. It's going to be contingent upon the voters and the municipalities. The municipalities are going to have to put together propositions. They're going to have to be approved by the voters. They're going to have to come up with dollar amounts associated with that. So there's so many contingencies in trying to evaluate that. I can't give you a good answer on that because it's going to be, you know, as it was pointed out earlier, Anchorage went to their voters just recently, and though it failed by a small margin, the voters did turn down a bond issue just recently. So, and Anchorage has had a good track record of approving bond propositions in the past. With that being said, you know, I really can't forecast how many of these municipalities out here who would qualify under this program would take a look to jump into the debt reimbursement program and see about taking care of their major maintenance. We could have a lot of major maintenance coming up over the next few years that's getting approved by the voters in these municipalities. In the near term, you're probably not going to see the program increase in size very dramatically. In the long term, it could happen. I mean, historically, we have seen the program down to $50 million annually and up to as much as $120 million annually over the 40 or 50 years that this program's been in place.
Representative Wolf.
Oh, thank you. This is for either the bill sponsor or the testifier, but the election in Anchorage that just barely lost for the bond, what was the reimbursement presented to the voters? 0%, and it barely lost. So I'm thinking for 50 or 60% reimbursement, that probably would have tipped the scales. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Well, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Question for Mr. Blackwell. If this bill passes and the moratorium is lifted, will there be a guarantee communicated to the municipalities and boroughs and to the voters that if they took advantage of the 70% reimbursement this year through a voter initiative or through a bond initiative at the elections in the fall, that those payments would then continue in following years?
Mr. Blackwell.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Carpenter. No, there would not be a statement of guaranteed payment because the annual payments are still subject to appropriation by the legislature. So even if they sold the bonds and we said that they would qualify at that rate, the annual reimbursement being subject to appropriation, we couldn't make that guarantee.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Pritchard. We'd heard from one of the testifiers that, there was a obligation of the state to pay bonds. Has there ever been a communication of a guarantee for reimbursement made under this program, you know, before the moratorium was established?
This is Elwin Blackwell through the chair, Representative Carpenter. To my knowledge, there has never been a communique to municipalities that they would, that there was a guarantee that they would receive the amount, 100% of their reimbursement. It's always been communicated that it is subject to legislative appropriation.
Follow-up.
Wonderful. Thank you. Through the chair, is there, with this bill, passage of this bill and a lifting of the moratorium, is there a limit, like an aggregate limit, that the state would be on the hook for in regards to the question on how many municipalities and boroughs may take advantage of the increase in reimbursement rate?
Mr. Blackwell?
Yes, and through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the way this bill is written, there is no cap on the amount of projects that the department could approve, and that could be subject to or a dollar amount that could be subject to reimbursement. So, So it's however many municipalities can get their voters to approve bond issues and them selling the bond issues. And those bonds then coming into the reimbursement pipeline through the next 10 to 20 years. They're within this bill, there is no cap on that number.
Representative Carpenter.
I don't think I have another question other than we've had a moratorium in place for a number of years now, and I think there's only a couple municipalities within the state who have decided to go to bond since the moratorium was put in place, even knowing that the state is in a fiscal challenge. So it sounds like that if this is to pass, we would be presenting to municipalities a blank check of sorts up to the 70% level when we haven't even gotten our fiscal house in order yet. So there is a whole lot more would have to happen to convince me to support this.
Great. Thank you, Representative Carpenter. And thank you, Representative Drummond, for being here to present today and all of our testifiers. This concludes our agenda for this afternoon. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9, so I will see you then. With that, at 3:18, we are adjourned. Thank you.